It's my pleasure to introduce Professors Bonnie Brenton and Martin Fujiki. Professors Brenton and Fujiki are in the Department of Audiology and Speech-Language Pathology. Their research focuses on the relationship between child language and social competence in children with language impairment. Professor Fujiki received his doctorate from the University of Utah in 1980. He is currently associate editor for the American Journal of Speech, Language, and Pathology and serves as editorial consultant to several other professional journals. He also serves as an editorial consultant to several publishers. Professor Fujiki is recognized nationally for his scholarship contributions to the field. He has served on the Brigham Young University Rank and Status Committee, both as a member and as vice chair, as well as the University Departmental Review Committee. Professor Fujiki was awarded in 2000 Fellow of the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, the highest honor of the association awarded to any of its members. Professor Brenton received her doctorate from the University of Utah in 1981. Professor Brenton is currently Dean of Graduate Studies at Brigham Young University and Professor of Audiology and Speech-Language Pathology. Professor Brenton is Associate Editor of Language, Speech, and Hearing Services in the schools and serves as editorial consultant for several other professional journals. Professor Brenton is nationally recognized for her scholarship and likewise was awarded in 1999 Fellow of the American Speech, Hearing, and Language Association, again the highest honor of the association awarded to any of its members. Since 1982, Professor Fujiki and Brenton have co-authored 36 articles in professional journals, 3 book chapters, and authored 2 books. They have presented over 70 joint papers at professional meetings. Professors Brenton and Fujiki were married in 1982 while on the faculty at the University of Nevada, Reno. Their greatest joys, however, are their 14-year-old son, Robert, and their 11-year-old daughter, Amanda. Truly, there are professors, professors. Professor Brenton and Fujiki.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's an honor to speak at this forum today, and we'd especially like to thank Dr. McPherson for his kind introduction and Dr. Channel and Sister Hart for offering prayers. We feel we should warn you, however, that Dr. McPherson is our department chair and friend and knows us very well. Dr. Channel is also a longtime friend and colleague going back to our days in graduate school. When we asked each of them individually to participate in this forum, they each said the same thing. They said, but then I'll have to listen to your forum. We promised them that they could slip out after we started, so gentlemen, now is your chance. We know that Sister Hart is much too gracious to slip out, that and she hasn't finished her degree yet, and we both sit on her graduate committee.
She hasn't prayed yet either.
We are both speech-language pathologists by trade. That means that we work with individuals who have a variety of disabilities that affect their ability to communicate with others. Today we'd like to tell you a little bit about the people we work with, about what's been going on at the BYU Language Pathology Lab in the last few years, and about some things we have learned along the way. Let us begin by introducing you to a child we will call Caleb. Caleb's parents were thrilled when he was born. He was a healthy, happy baby. He seemed to grow and develop normally, but as he matured, his mother noticed some things about him that were different from his older brothers. For example, Caleb did not enjoy sitting on her lap while she read stories to him like her other children had. Caleb's first words were slow in coming. Her other children had produced their first words around their first birthdays. Caleb's first birthday came and went without his beginning to talk. By his second birthday, Caleb's sentences were limited to a few single words. What's more, Caleb didn't always seem to understand what people were saying to him. He didn't follow simple directions. He still did not enjoy it when his mother tried to read children's books to him. He shuffled through the pictures quickly and would not wait for her to read the text beneath the pictures. Despite problems with language, Caleb was an outgoing, charming, enthusiastic people person. And because of these positive characteristics, his parents hoped that his language development would kick in over time. They made sure that his environment was stimulating and interactive. As Caleb's third birthday came and went, he still could not express himself. He spoke in short, simple utterances. For example, if he were playing outside and a big dog chased a rabbit across the yard, Caleb would not be able to express this to his parents so they would know what had happened. The nagging fear that his parents had begun to feel over the past year or so intensified. Caleb was 4 and a half when his mother took him to a large children's medical center where he saw a team of pediatric specialists. This included a neurologist, a speech-language pathologist, and a psychologist. The testing showed a jagged profile of strengths and weaknesses. On nonverbal portions of an intelligence test, that is, on testing tasks that did not require Caleb to understand language or to talk, he performed very well. This confirmed that Caleb was a bright child who was ready to learn. On tests that demanded Caleb understand or produce language, however, Caleb performed significantly below what would be expected of a child of his age. For example, he had difficulty understanding single words and simple sentences. He could not complete simple commands. He struggled to name objects, repeat phrases, and produce sentences. Caleb's ability to both understand and express spoken language was impaired. The diagnostic team explained to Caleb's mother that Caleb had language impairment. They told her that she could expect this language impairment to affect every aspect of Caleb's learning and that it would persist over time. Caleb's mother couldn't help but wonder what caused this problem. The team explained that language impairment was not caused by hearing loss, by deprivation, by neglect, by emotional disturbance, or by mental retardation. In fact, Caleb's parents would probably never know what caused this problem. Caleb's mother tried to understand what this disability would mean to her son and to her family. As she called her husband on the phone and tried to explain the diagnosis, she collapsed on the floor in tears. Her husband prayed desperately for a cure, and they both knew their lives had been changed.
Caleb had a disability that is often labeled a specific language impairment. Other labels sometimes used to refer to this condition include developmental language disorder or language learning disorder. Recent research has demonstrated that about 7% of kindergartners have specific language impairment. We love to work with and learn about these children. In fact, it was our interest in these children that brought us together as research collaborators when we were students and later as life collaborators. Children with specific language impairment have been the focus of most of our research here at BYU. Let's take a moment and try and understand what it's like to grow up with language impairment. A child with specific language impairment does not usually look or act differently from other children as a baby. Subtle differences in very early development are sometimes evident only in retrospect. The first, most obvious manifestation of language impairment is the child usually does not begin to talk when most children do. In addition, a very young child with language impairment may not be as responsive to parents when they talk. Since the child does not respond to the parent in a way that the parent expects, the child may be difficult to interact with. Anybody who's ever had a conversation with a typical 2-year-old knows that you have to provide a lot of support to keep the interaction going. A child with language impairment needs even more support and can be a lot of work to build a conversation with this child. As a child with language impairment reaches school age, he enters a context where his disability will be very evident. Nearly every school task is conducted through the medium of spoken language. The teacher explains rules, gives directions, and disciplines students, all by talking. Students are expected to demonstrate knowledge by responding verbally to questions or probes. The vast majority of instructional content in all subjects is conveyed via language, spoken at first and later written. Since talking and listening do not come easily, children with language impairment may use information through other means, such as seeing or acting on objects. This information may help, but it will not compensate. Reading and writing are particularly difficult since they represent language in another form. Children who cannot speak grammatical sentences will not write them, and children who cannot understand complex verbal forms cannot be expected to recognize these forms in print. Many children with specific language impairment do better at math tests that involve manipulatives that they can see and handle. Even elementary school math quickly begins to involve verbal logic and word problems, however, and these usually constitute a stumbling block. Language impairment is not something we can expect children to grow out of, Rather, it tends to persist over time. The nature and symptoms of language impairment tend to change as a child matures. For example, for a three-year-old, the most obvious symptom may be the fact that the child can only produce a few words. When that same child is 13, the major manifestations of language impairment may include difficulty drawing inferences from spoken or written text, an inability to construct a coherent spoken narrative, and problems interpreting figurative language forms.
To appreciate what it's like to have language impairment, let's engage in a little exercise of the imagination. Imagine that you were born into a world where everyone has a clarinet in their hand. People communicate by playing the clarinet. They express love, anger, and joy to each other by playing tunes on their clarinets. The evening news is broadcast as the anchor plays the clarinet. Everyone knows what these tunes mean. When you were born, like other babies, you cannot play the clarinet. You blow lots of noises and squeaks, but your parents find these noises quite delightful. They express their love for you by playing little tunes that are easy for babies to pick out from the other sounds in the environment. Other babies quickly recognize these tunes and start to play notes of their own. You, on the other hand, can't make sense of the tunes that are played around you. You can't seem to remember them, or maybe you can't pick them out from the background music. In any event, the tunes don't mean much to you. You manage to make some squeaks, and eventually you eke out a few notes, and your parents are thrilled. Finally, you've started to play. Other kids your age, however, are playing songs like Go Tell Aunt Rhody and Mary Had a Little Lamb. No one gave these children formal clarinet lessons. They just seemed to learn naturally as they communicated with their parents with their clarinets. Now, you try to communicate with your parents, too, and by the time you get to kindergarten, you can play Mary Had a Little Lamb just fine. Hooray! The only problem is the other kids are playing sonatas by Handel, and the teacher is communicating to everyone by playing Beethoven symphonies. You try to figure out what's going on, but it is hard to find tunes that you understand within the music around you. You often don't know what to do or where to go at school because you can only pick out bits and pieces of what the teacher is playing. With school comes another challenge. What are those weird dots and lines the teacher is writing on the board? The kids seem to get meaning from those marks the teacher calls notes, but you can't figure out what they represent. By the end of the second grade, you've made progress. You can communicate your basic needs playing tunes, and you can recognize what the teacher means when she plays Clair de Lune. You can even recognize and write a few notes on the staff. But uh-oh, the other kids in your class are composing symphonies, and the instruction is geared to their level. You work harder and harder, but you get more and more behind in school. Clarinet music is the means of communicating in your culture, but clarinet music is your Achilles heel. What seems to come easily for other children is difficult and laborious for you. Those of us whose musical ability is limited to turning on the stereo would find the clarinet world a pretty scary and frustrating place. Our language world is the same for children with language impairment. These children are up against some serious barriers. As we mentioned previously, those barriers are most obvious in the classroom. Language impairment quickly undermines a child's performance in school because spoken and written language permeates all parts of the school day. Language impairment is at the core of many learning disabilities. But language impairment affects more than academics. It takes its toll on something else just as important. And that something else is social interaction, which in turn impedes human relationships. It is at the point of interface between language impairment and social relationships we have concentrated our research.
Please bear with us while we give you a little perspective on how our work fits in with the research base in our discipline. Traditionally, research in language impairment concentrated on the linguistic manifestations of the disorder, that is, on the child's ability to produce and understand words and to build those words into grammatical sentences. Children with language impairment have difficulty learning new words quickly, and they especially struggle producing the grammatical morphemes that signal meaning and make utterances sound acceptable. Traditional intervention concentrated on helping children acquire new words and learn to produce grammatical forms correctly. When we were doctoral students, we began to shift our attention away from the basic forms of language to more conversational aspects of language. In our first published paper in 1982, We reported our finding that children with language impairment did not just have difficulty with words and sentences. They also struggled to accommodate to their listeners in conversation. They could not use their language to respond to the questions, probes, and comments of others in spontaneous interaction. We were fascinated by the results of our early studies in the conversational aspects of language impairment, and we wanted to pursue this line of work. It seemed, however, that after a brief period of interest in the more pragmatic manifestations of language impairment, a major research arm of our discipline was headed back to the examination and treatment of language form. And we wondered if we wanted to swim upstream. After all, the journals we wanted to publish in were touting a very high rejection rate, and we wondered if we'd be able to get any audience for our work. It was at this point that the Lord intervened in our careers in a very dramatic way. We were both working for State University in the Western United States, and our positions allowed little time for research except between the hours of 6 in the evening and 12 midnight. We were desperate for the chance to pay more attention to our research. Against all odds, we were both offered full-time research appointments working for the University of Kansas, a hotbed of research in developmental disabilities, including language impairment. We were stationed at a research satellite located in southeastern Kansas. The good news was we had every day, all day, to write grants and carry out research. The bad news was we were living in a town of 12,000 people, and we did not have access to sufficient numbers of children with language impairment to work with. We did, however, have convenient access to a different clinical population, adults with mild disabilities, including language problems. The Lord had, in essence, provided us with a population that could show us the results of years of living with a language problem and what behaviors would be important to an individual's ability to take a meaningful place in society. We carried out several fairly ambitious studies. We wanted to know what aspects of language were important to an individual's ability to live and function within a community. Here's what we found out. Individuals who were the best integrated within their communities were also those who could use their language, even though it was impaired, to meet the needs of others in conversation. And as soon as we learned this, we very unexpectedly received a pair of job offers from BYU. When we relocated to Provo, we finished up the studies we had begun in Kansas, and we then again focused our research on children with language impairment. But this time, we felt we had a mission. We felt compelled to discover how children with language impairment use their language in social interaction. We came to feel that there were questions appointed for us to tackle. Those questions included, how well are children with language impairment able to interact with their peers in social context? What is the social world of a child with language impairment like?
Addressing these questions required us to develop some rather unconventional research tasks and analysis systems. We started by conducting fairly spontaneous conversations with children and by inserting probes into those conversations that required the child to respond to the needs of their conversational partner. For example, in one task, we would talk with the child, then at a reasonable point in the conversation, we would introduce a fairly evocative topic and then pass the floor to the child. For instance, we might say something like, "Last night I went to McDonald's. I got a shake. I spilled it all over my pants." We would then wait for the child to respond. We found that a typically developing child will respond to this topic by saying something like, "Oh, gross," or by asking, "What did you do?" Some of the children with language impairment responded as expected, but what was interesting was that about half of the children with language impairment responded quite differently. It was this latter pattern of response that is illustrated in the following video. In the following example, a 7-year-old boy with language impairment is presented with this probe. As you will see, he seems very amused at the comment and he bursts into laughter. Well, so far, so good. His subsequent response, however, is not tied to the investigator's topic at all. He enthusiastically begins to discuss an episode of Ren and Stimpy. And he says, and I quote, "I watch Ren and Stimpy, and this guy was mad. And know what? Yeah, and it is, and he and Stimpy was in that dungeon with that mean old man," end quote. As you watch, keep in mind that they have not been talking about Ren and Stimpy, and this comment seems to come out of the blue. But also note that he is able and willing to play an active role in the conversation, but he cannot gear his contribution to his conversational partner.
"Let me tell you one more thing."
"What?"
"Do you like to eat at McDonald's?" "I went to McDonald's last night, and I got a shake, and I spilled it all over my pants."
Whoa. I like being stupid and the sky was red. Mm-hmm. And the what?
What?
Yeah, and when Stinky was in the dungeon with that mean old man.
We had to ask ourselves, what would the social ramifications of this kind of conversational behavior be? What impact would this kind of behavior have on other children in conversation? We wanted to understand more about how children with language impairment interacted in real-life contexts. We wanted to look at at conversations that were as spontaneous and natural as possible. And we wanted to remove ourselves as adults from the conversation and look at the way children talk when they're together. Now, spontaneous kid-to-kid interactions don't tend to develop within research laboratories. This meant that our research team, including ourselves and our graduate and our undergraduate students, had to pack up our recording equipment and find settings where real children were doing real social things. We are more than grateful to several school districts for letting us become part of their elementary school routine so that we could observe children in real-life settings. We have been privileged to work with bright, talented graduate and undergraduate students. And on the monitor here are some of the students who have been instrumental to these research projects and with whom we have collaborated, presented, and published. Most of them are still speaking to us. That's the miracle. Now, we targeted social interactional tasks that are common in the social world of children, things that are important for kids to be able to do in order to interact with their peers. Now, let us tell you about a few of those studies. One thing that children need to be able to do in their social world is to join other children who are already playing. This entering behavior is often referred to as access. We set up a social context where two typically developing children who had not previously met each other were introduced. We supplied interesting toys for these children to play with, and we helped them get interaction going. After they were playing together, we brought a third child into the room. We introduced the third child to the two who were already playing, and then we left the room for 20 minutes. We wanted to know if the third child would be able to join the other two children and access the play. We video recorded the entire interaction, and later our graduate and undergraduate student research assistants transcribed everything each child said during the entire interaction. We also considered the nonverbal behavior of each child throughout the interaction. We figured that a child might enter the interaction by talking with the other children, or by making a nonverbal contribution to the play, or by both. Finding reliable ways to transcribe and analyze these interactions was incredibly time-consuming and laborious, but we drew on a large body of literature studying typical children, and especially on an earlier study on children with language impairment done by Craig and Washington at the University of Michigan. Our results corroborated Craig and Washington's findings. We found that typically developing children could all enter the interaction and join the other two children at play fairly quickly and easily. For children with language impairment, it was a different story. If they were able to enter the play, they did so slowly. One child entered the play and then left the interaction to wander about by himself. Some children were never able to enter the interaction. They stood by a wall, hovered, or watched for 20 minutes, but they never became part of the play. For the children who did gain initial access to the play, we investigated whether they would then become part of the group for an extended period of time. Here again, the answer was no. They played minimal roles in the interaction. Now, we wondered, was it the case that children with language impairment really couldn't interact with their peers, or were they just apathetic and unmotivated to do so?
We decided to try something different. What if we could set up a scenario where children would be really motivated to interact with their peers, where they would not be content to sit comfortably by and watch? Once again, we worked with triads. We placed one child with language impairment with two typically developing peers. We had the children perform a simple task for us, and then we gave each child three plastic chips as payment. We then showed the children a small vending machine full of treats. We told them they could buy a treat with their chips. Now, the only catch was that each treat cost four or more chips, and no individual had more than three chips. We told the children to work together and decide what to buy. We then left them alone. As we had hoped, every child, including each child with language impairment, was most anxious to get a treat, and each child seemed to care very much about which treat was purchased. An active period of negotiation ensued. We transcribed and analyzed these negotiations. Although children with language impairment negotiated actively, they used less mature strategies than did their typically developing peers. As a result, they usually did not influence the decision. The two typical children in the group came to a consensus, and the child with language impairment was left out of the deal-making. Negotiation is a vital part of the social world of children, and children with language impairment can't use their language to negotiate very effectively. Now, we asked ourselves, how extensive was the difficulty with children with language impairment? How extensive was the difficulty that children with language impairment experienced? We decided to look at situations that occurred frequently in the classroom. We were interested in cooperative groups where children interact and work together to accomplish a common goal. We carefully set these groups up so that a child who could not talk or understand language very well could find plenty of meaningful work to do nonverbally. Again, we worked with triads containing one child with language impairment and two typically developing peers. We found that children with language impairment rarely played a meaningful part in the group work. They contributed even less nonverbally than they did verbally. They simply could not hold their own in a group of three. We found this was the case even when we assigned the children with language impairment important roles to play in the cooperative work. For example, we tried putting them in charge of all the materials that the group would need to complete a project. It didn't help. The children with language impairment were still on the outskirts of the interaction.
Okay, we thought. We've set up situations that are common in the child's experience, but still somewhat structured, and we've observed consistent results. But how deep into the child's world did the problem extend? What would happen if we could watch these children in play that was free from almost all adult input or structure? Well, we packed up our cameras and headed out to the playground for recess. With the help of small mobile cameras and wireless microphones disguised as friendship necklaces, we obtained video and audio recordings of children with language impairment as they went out to recess at school. Once again, we transcribed everything these children said and everything that was said to them. We analyzed their play behavior using an ingenious system developed by Dr. Craig Hart from Marriage, Family, and Human Development here at BYU. The results echoed our previous work. Children with language impairment, unlike typically developing children, spent much of their recess time alone. They wandered from playgroup to playgroup without ever really gaining access to the play. This study provided us with one particularly poignant and informative moment that was not really captured by our quantitative analyses. We happened to catch an interaction among a few typically developing children. They were talking about a girl in the first grade class who had language impairment. This little girl, whom we will call Amy, was frequently withdrawn, but occasionally quite aggressive as well. The little girls plotted to approach Amy and say some rude things. Subsequently, we observed Amy, who sat alone on a basketball staring into space. The little girls gingerly approached Amy, and the interaction went something like this. The girls said, in voices dripping with sarcasm, "We really like your clothes." Then they ran away laughing, evidently expecting Amy to aggress. Amy remained stoic. The little girls approached a little closer, and again, dripping with sarcasm, said, "We really like your black hair." Amy did not react in any visible way. A third time they approached, closer still this time, and said, "We really like your brown skin," laughed, and ran away. Still Amy sat on the basketball. From nowhere, another little girl appeared, approached Amy, and put her arm around her. This little girl tried to help Amy interpret the situation by saying gently, "They're pretending to be nice to you, but they don't really like you." She then added, "But I like you." We were touched by the small act of first grade heroism, but Amy did not react or respond in any visible way. Amy was evidently unable to understand the intent of the verbal insults, and she was just as unable to understand the intent of the verbally expressed love and support. She could not make use of either type of social information. Amy seemed so totally alone.
So what is the fallout of the difficulty that children with language impairment experience in social interactions with their peers? A concurrent line of research that we have been pursuing indicates that children with language impairment as a group tend to be withdrawn at school. They stand around doing nothing, even when there is plenty to do, and they seem fearful or too anxious to join in group play. They sometimes engage in pretend activities alongside of, but not with, other children. These types of withdrawn behaviors are especially concerning because they are often associated with peer rejection in children. In fact, our work suggests that children with language impairment are often poorly accepted by their peers, and they rarely have reciprocal friendships. Outside of school, they have few peers they can do fun things with, such as play at each other's houses or talk on the phone or have sleepovers. They report feeling lonely at school. As one fifth grader with language impairment expressed, "I'm like a broken toy. I just get passed from one person to another. Nobody wants to play with a broken toy." Sometimes we're asked, "Why do you do this kind of work? Doesn't it depress you?" Well, of course it depresses us. We care deeply about these children, and it is difficult to watch their social struggles. But knowledge is power. How can we help a child if we don't exactly know where that child's strengths and challenges are? Our overriding research goal is not to illustrate the social difficulties of children with language impairment and then let it rest there. That is just the start. The compelling question is, what are we going to do about it? How do we help a child like Amy learn to use language to communicate in such a way that she can form and maintain social relationships with others? Traditional interventions for a child like Amy would concentrate on improving the form of her language and supporting her academic work. Now, we feel this type of intervention is important, but we do not feel that it is sufficient. We have been developing techniques and methods to facilitate social language behaviors that can help build healthy peer relationships.
Facilitating social language behaviors is a tricky proposition. It's not just a matter of teaching specific social skills. For example, let's say that we wanted to teach a child to make a certain type of validating comment. A validating comment is an utterance that offers validation or support to another individual. A compliment is a type of validating comment. Okay, compliments are easy. So we teach a child with language impairment to approach his peers and say, "Hey, that's a good shirt." Let's say the child learns exactly what we taught him and starts to generalize the behavior, approaching every kid he sees and saying, "Hey, that's a good shirt." His peers quickly pick up on the fact that it doesn't matter what kind of shirt they have on, this little boy is likely to say, "Hey, that's a good shirt." Now, what if the little boy walks up to the class tough guy who has just been in a brawl on the playground and has ripped his shirt in six places? Our little boy says, "Hey, that's a good shirt." The little boy has done exactly what we taught him, and he's likely to get his lights punched out because of it. Social language behaviors are only appropriate if they are closely geared to the context in which they are produced, and social contexts are constantly changing. We have found that what we must do to help children with language impairment is to help them gear what they say to this ever-changing context, and this is very difficult for them. Let's go back to validating comments. Validating comments are very important in children's relationships, and we have found that children with language impairment very rarely offer validating comments to their peers. Can we help them do this in a flexible, appropriate way? Yes, our preliminary work suggests that perhaps we can. First, we help the child understand what validating comments are and how they make people feel. Next, we draw the child's attention to the actions and play of peers. Third, we help the child select an aspect of the peer's behavior to offer a supportive comment on. For example, a peer barely misses a game move. The child says, "Oh, almost." The next try, the peer succeeds. The child says, "You did it." The final component is to help the child assess how the comment was received by the peer. This demands focusing on and interpreting the facial expressions, actions, and words of others. This kind of treatment isn't easy, and it is quick. We're finding it must be done over and over and over again. But hard work and persistence are a way of life when working with children with language impairment. In fact, we are often amazed at how hard these children work in the face of such significant challenges.
Even though we have been working with children with language impairment for 20 years now, we feel as if we have just begun. There are so many unanswered questions. For example, we know there is a relationship between language impairment and social competence, but we are a long way from fully understanding how that relationship works. It is more than a simple matter of language problems leading directly to social problems. Rather, language impairment and social competence are intertwined in development. But how exactly? This much we do know. Children with language impairment are at risk for school failure because their language problems undermine their academic success. Just as importantly, however, these children are at risk for social failure. Many of these children will have difficulty establishing and maintaining good peer relationships, and these difficulties are not likely to resolve spontaneously with time. Children with language impairment need specific, carefully planned interventions designed to carry out two goals. One is to support their academic progress, and the second is to facilitate their interactions with peers, We believe these two goals can be met simultaneously as speech-language pathologists, teachers, special educators, psychologists, and parents team together to design and carry out educational plans.
There is one additional insight that we've gained from our work here at BYU that we did not anticipate. In our years of working with children with language impairment, we have come to understand just how much we expect from these children. We ask them to work especially hard on exactly those things that are most difficult for them. We do this knowing that they will improve and progress, but also knowing that they will continue to struggle with so many things. A child with language impairment, like many other individuals with disabilities, often finds himself in the position where no matter how hard he tries, he still falls behind his peers. Things are just harder for him. If this child compares himself to his peers, as of course virtually all children in our culture learn to do, he will discover that he performs less well at school, he is less popular, and he has fewer friends. Ah, you may say, but what we need to do here is find something at which the child is really adept, something he can do well, a place where he excels. This is a great idea, in theory. In fact, this is a theme that runs through our stories and films and literature. The underdog finds his true talent and excels despite the odds. For example, one of our children's favorite novels is Yang the Youngest and His Terrible Ear by Lenzi Namioka. This book tells the story of a fourth child born into a family of gifted musicians. The youngest child does not have the music in him, however, and disgraces his family with his miserable attempts at the violin. As the story unfolds, he finds that he's a natural athlete and he excels on the local baseball team. His family recognizes that his gift is different from theirs, but they learn to value it. Everyone lives happily ever after. This is a great story, but it is just that, fiction. In real life, if you have a disability such as language impairment, you are almost always at least a step behind your peers in just about everything. Moments of rising above the crowd or even drawing even with the crowd are few and far between, yet you are expected to work hard all the time to try and close a gap that never narrows. Where do you find the strength to keep going? We have come to discover that the only way we can motivate a child to put in the effort needed to keep the learning curve moving upward is to help that child understand where her true value comes from. In this society where excellence is constantly measured on a comparative and competitive scale, a child needs to understand that it doesn't matter what anyone else can do or learn. What matters is that each child is a child of God, beloved equally with everyone else. The value of the mortal existence is not where we start or even where we end. It's the growth we experience along the way. So many times we wanted to hold a child in our arms and look into her eyes and say, I know this is hard for you. It doesn't matter. You are a child of a divine heavenly Father, and your value is infinite. You can keep going. Do your very best. It'll be enough. We must somehow learn to convey this to children. And we know we probably won't be able to do it through words. We'll find other ways. We feel that this is a task that we should be working on here at BYU. And we will probably spend the rest of our professional lives dealing with the issues we've been talking about today. We hope to be able to make a contribution to meeting BYU's second institutional objective, to advance truth and knowledge. And we hope to do it in such a way to improve the quality of life for children with language impairment. And we'd like to thank all of you for being with us here today.